That's great. Have I got the mic on? Yes, I have. Great. Thanks very much. And welcome. So we're going to be talking about debt, the burden of debt, and you'll have seen the blurb in the programme. I'm Kit Beasley. I'm the head of finance for Triodos Bank in the UK. It's a European bank based in Holland. We operate in branches in about 5 countries around the UK. It's a sustainable bank. And I suppose our mission is to try and make people conscious of how they use their money. And in order to do that, we're very transparent about how we use our customers' money, where it goes, publish a full list of all of the organisations that we lend to. So my fellow panellists are Katie Curtis, Michael Northcott, Heather Roy and Tim Jones, and they're going to introduce themselves very shortly, and they will do a little bit about what's their angle on this topic. So I'm not going to say much about my angle on the topic as such, because I'm a banker and I don't know where some of them might be coming from. But what I would just like to do is, and I apologise for repeating this because I've said it in the talk that I gave earlier on today, but I'd just like to remind people about the relationship between money and debt. Debt came way before money. So as soon as one person did something for another, even in the earliest prehistoric communities, if that other person hadn't yet delivered something in return, that was a debt. Never mind that they didn't have any money. So the debt came first. If I went out and slayed a boar and then brought it back for somebody to cook, until they had cooked it, they owed me some food. So that's a debt. And it's progressed through time, started to be recorded on tablets of stone or slate, and then those started to be swapped around between people because it was easier, and you could sort of trade this debt, if you like. And then it became turned into coins, which were represented as so gold and silver, and in some places shekels, which is a fixed measure of a certain weight of wheat. So money kind of followed on as a way of recording and transferring debt. So the debt started off then, but what has happened is that money has allowed people to kind of move away from the social transaction that was debt into something that's a bit more impersonal. And it's also allowed some of that debt to be moved around in ways that are invisible. And so perhaps one of the things we can talk about is kind of how the system has allowed that to happen. So that's me, and I'd just like to hand over to Katie. And then when they've all done their intros, it's kind of over to you guys to ask us some questions. Just speak.
Thanks, Kit. No, it did work. Hello, my name's Katie Curtis. I'm a campaigns officer at the Children's Society. And as was spoken about earlier, what I'm going to speak to today is about the impact and the effect that debt has on children, and that sort of angle to the conversation that's happening around personal debt at the moment. So for the last 8 months, so in about October last year, the Children's Society decided it wanted to do something to look into a bit more this issue of debt and its effect on children and how it was impacting these children that we'd seen anecdotally through our practice arm and that we'd heard about. And so like any good organisation that runs campaigns that are research and evidence-led, we went out to find out what was out there about this issue of children and how they were being affected by their parents' debt. There was little to nothing. So it was quite good that we were starting from a place where we could do all the research ourselves. What was bad was that we were starting from a base where it felt like nobody had ever actually spoken about how this... We'd spoken about personal debt, we'd spoken about national debt, and we'd spoken about debt internationally, but we hadn't actually started speaking about how these debts were affecting the youngest and some of the most vulnerable in our society. So we did know that problem debt was becoming a problem, a society problem. And so we've gone about for the last 8 months trying to lift the lid on how around 2.5 million children are living in families with problem debt. Behind on a worrying, and I don't know how you would count this very easily, 4.8 billion of payments on household bills and low repayments. And with millions more families who are very, very close to the edge of falling into the debt trap. And the lack of information about how this was impacting the children in that family, in those families, would make you think, certainly made us think, that perhaps we were looking at the wrong thing. Perhaps this wasn't an issue, wasn't as big an issue as we thought it was. However, the reality is that far from being innocent bystanders to debt, children are actually bearing the brunt of what's happening. Our research revealed that for most of them, they're not a bit immune at all from the impact of the family debt. Every aspect of children's lives is being affected, from basic necessities through to their family relationships with their parents and their siblings, through to their experiences that they're having at school. Every single thing they were doing in their life was being impacted by the fact that they was a family in problem debt. And these families were experienced financial hardship that was contributed to by the continuing squeeze that we've seen on the cost of living, by rising fuel bills, by welfare cuts that we've seen that are the most draconian in a generation. And a growing number of these families are parents that are in an insecure job market. So these are people that are forced into part-time work or into employment that's 0 hours contract. So they have no security and where their money's coming from. The reality is that parents are being affected by all of this and more, and they're more vulnerable to debt difficulties than those without children. So if you've got children, the presence of children in your household makes it more likely that you could be hit by an unexpected bill that you're less likely to be able to pay because you don't have the means to reduce your spending in the wake of an income shock. So these are families that are unable, if they are hit by redundancy or by something happening in their household, their boiler breaking or the car breaking down, the chances of them being able to fix those things immediately are very difficult if there's a presence of a child in a house. And what we're finding is that these families are having to turn to credit when there is an issue, where there's an income shock or where there's a disparity between their income and their outgoings. And far from what some of the media would have you believe, these families are not turning to credit for luxuries. A third of the families that we spoke to are turning to credit, to payday loans, to other forms of credit, just so that they can pay for the essentials and the necessities to get through every single day. But when you look at problem debt and the issues it causes, it's not unique, not to this century, not even to this country. But what is unique, and for me, for someone who's working on this, more than a little bit depressing, is that I'm not talking about just any nation. I'm talking about one of the richest nations on earth, where children are going to bed at night worrying about how their parents are paying the bills. We live in a country where there's a record number of billionaires and a record number of people who have to take food off of friends and strangers just to put meals on the table for their families. This isn't good enough, and we need to do something about this. But to finish on a more positive note, that we can do something about this. Reducing the impact of problem debt on children is possible, but it is going to take a concerted effort by us in the communities, by us in the charity movement, by creditors, by regulators, and most importantly, by the government, to address not only the problems that people are seeing, but the root causes. Why are these people, why are these families getting in debt? And why, when they're in debt, do they not have the resilience to get out the other side without the impact and the effect that it's having on them and their children? So that's what we're doing. The Children's Society are now lifting the lid and trying to find the best ways to alleviate these problems for these families. And the fact that so many of you are here tonight to help us start this conversation is heartwarming. And I hope that through our debates tonight, we can find a way where we might be able to help these families out. There are families in this country where parents are laying awake at night wondering how they're going to pay for the essentials for their children, for their school uniforms, how they're going to put meals on the table at night. And them children of those families are staying awake at night doing the same. So thank you for being here and thank you for helping some way to go away to help these families.
Hello, very loud microphone, excuse me. You'll have heard, if you live in the UK, as I guess most of you do, that the country... I'm sorry, my name is Michael Northcott. Perhaps we weren't introduced, I'm sorry, I thought we had been. Michael Northcott, I'm Professor of Ethics in the University of Edinburgh. I'm author of a number of books that are in the bookshop if you're interested in buying any of them. They're mainly on climate change and environmental issues. There is a book called Custer Bonds, Cleanse and Cuttlefish. There are essays in there about debt. You will have heard that the UK was in serious debt when we had the last general election. Indeed, George Osborne made out that we were as indebted as Greece and Portugal. This is a complete lie. In fact, we are one of the richest countries in the world. We had relatively small debt at the last election. The main reason for the what debt there was the bailing out of the city. It was not welfare payments, as we're constantly being told, or support for other public services. However, George Osborne was determined to make what he said come true. So as a result of the policies that we've had in the last 3 years in the UK, public debt has quadrupled. In the name of austerity, but in fact they've used significant amounts of money in increased budgets in to reorganise welfare, to reorganise secondary schools, to reorganise the National Health Service, and to reorganise the universities, my public sector I work in, all of which has cost vast sums of money, and all of them were designed to sell these services to private companies. Setting up the markets in all these services has cost a fantastic amount of money, and is one of the main causes we're now in more debt than we were before the last election. Now, the other problem is, of course, that having said the country is unaffordably in debt, Osborne then went on to attack the poor as the cause of it. Of course, Labour as well, but I mean, we'll leave Labour out of it, Labour Party, I mean, the last government. And essentially what he's told us again and again is that lazy people on sofas are the cause of the country's problems, and therefore these people have to be cut off without a penny. National insurance was invented in 1945 as a genuine social security scheme. People paid into a real fund which followed them around. And when they got ill or were sick, the fund was theirs and they drew it down. In the 1960s, some clever civil servant thought it would be rather a good wheeze to abandon the fund and just to turn it into a tax. So about a month ago, a man in England with only £4 in his bank account died of hunger, because his social security benefits had been cut off. He didn't have any children dependent on him. But of course, the same cuts in social security benefits have had incredible effects on children or on pregnant women. And allied with those cuts have been further cuts on people on low wages who are, because of our iniquitously low minimum wage, also reliant on social security payments and other forms of government assistance. So cuts in housing benefit, the so-called spare bedroom tax, these have all loaded more and more debt on the poor, but constantly we've been told by the media these are all necessary because of the debt laid up by the last government. So unfortunately we've been told a large amount of lies about debt, and much of this lying has been to cover up a quite systematic, in my view, intention by the government to transfer wealth from the poor to the rich in the period of this government in the name of austerity. And I think it's really tragic. But the most tragic effects are not the destruction of the NHS, not privatisation of the universities or the schools, but are indeed on the lives of very poor people, and the Children's Society and others have documented this in their reports. I know a little of the work of something called the Zacchaeus Trust, and Paul Nicholson, a clergyman in London, through that trust, has drawn attention to medical research carried out in universities like mine, which demonstrates very clearly a relationship between poor maternal nutrition, low birth weight, and brain development in young children. This government is storing up appalling problems for the next generation by basically systematically cutting off essential income to the poor and loading them with debt. Of course, this is against the Bible. It's clearly against the teachings of the Old Testament and the New Testament. Christ's first sermon in the synagogue in Capernaum was a direct reference to the Jubilee year, the acceptable year of the Lord. He quotes it in it. The first time Christ quotes scripture in the New Testament, he refers to the Jubilee year, and he says in his coming, debts will be forgiven. And that marked that belief that the Jubilee was reinvented in Christ's coming by the early Christians was then universalized, so that usury, lending money to interest, was banned in Christendom for 1,500 years, basically until the late Middle Ages. And this country is now piling up usurious debts on the poorest. To me, it's an absolute tragedy and a scandal. The church has done something about this, but I think that much more needs to be done. Most of all, what we need in this country is a government regulatory limit on the amount of interest anybody can legally charge. And I have written to my MP, and I've through him to George Osborne. You always get the standard letter back, but it's worth writing. This is incredibly important that we have this law in this country. You could legally lend money at 5,000% interest rate in this country, and a lot of the poorest are borrowing at that rate, and it's utterly scandalous. And it is, for me, one of the most pertinent issues that we Christians have to witness and campaign upon if we're to continue to live in a country which has any vestiges left of Christian charity and the way that it's run. Thank you very much.
Well, before somebody asks me, I'll say that my name's Heather Roy, and I have the pleasure of working for a European organisation based in Brussels in Belgium called Eurodiaconia. And the problem is that in the UK, diaconia is not a word that we particularly often use to describe the social and charitable justice work of the churches. But essentially, our organisation is a European network of churches and church-related organisations that provide social and healthcare services and are advocates for social justice. And we're active in 32 countries in Europe, not only in the European Union, and represent around about, the latest estimate is about 35,000 providers of social and healthcare services that do so from a Christian tradition and basis. And our members in the UK, as we are here at Greenbelt, include the Salvation Army, the Free Churches Group, and the Church of Scotland, not the Church of England. You can ask me why afterwards. But we're working from a European perspective. And it's fair to say that since the financial and economic crisis of 2008, our members have seen an increase in certain types of services needed across Europe. And those were in three categories: housing and homelessness services, food support, so food banks, and the third one was debt. And our members and our organisation is now looking at how we can ensure that across Europe we have good practice when it comes to providing debt assistance services, and also looking at what policies need to change on a European level as well as a national level. And the two, believe it or not, do actually relate to each other, unlike some ways it's presented from the UK. But we're very much looking at what is it that needs to change on a European level that can reduce the experience of debt for people in the most vulnerable situations. And we would start by saying that the whole area of debt and bad debt, because there is at times good debt as well, is completely multifaceted. We cannot blame it on only one cause. We cannot blame it on only one government, because the instance of debt is all across Europe. It's not just in the UK, and we cannot blame the current government for what's happening in some other countries as well. But we want to look at the reasons, we want to look at the impact of over-indebtedness, and we want to look at solutions. And when we think about reasons, we perhaps could look at four reasons. And the one is, which is very, very clear in the Children's Society report, which is income shock, when there is a change to household income. But the other reasons include struggles with personal financial management. None of us are perfect. And we do need to look, when it comes to solutions, at financial education. Another reason that we have found for over-indebtedness is for some people who are excluded from financial activities, who, for example, are denied access to a bank account, to a basic bank account. And in the last year, we, as along with other organisations, have campaigned that it's now European law that everybody has access to basic banking services. That has not been the case up till now. And it can be very difficult if you can't access a bank account to operate in the current financial and banking ways. And the fourth point we would pick up, we're a Christian organisation and we like to look beyond just the material, is also our concept of values today. Our consumerism and consumptive culture. Not because people get in debt just because they want to have a big TV. We have to be very careful about that and about polarising people who experience debt. But actually it's more about how is it we believe we look successful in society? How do we think we are valued? Are we valued because of who we are, or are we valued about what we've got? And if as a society we value people as to what they've got, there is greater pressure to have, and that's something we want to look at. Impact, I think that Katie has touched on many of that already. We absolutely agree about the impact that happens in health and relationships. There is spiritual implications, there are social implications and educational implications, particularly for children. But when it comes to solutions, our members are involved in all different types of work. I know there's great work happening in the UK, so I won't repeat that because I think most of you know the work of Christians Against Poverty and others. But in the Netherlands, for example, the Protestant Church in the Netherlands run a debt buddy project where in every parish there are two trained volunteers to counsel people locally on dealing with debt. In every parish. And they have rolled that out across the Netherlands. In the UK, there's a lot of talk now about starting credit unions, and that could be something for us to touch on later. But we also see a number of church banks emerging. We also see churches, for example, the Church of Finland, being willing to pay off part of some people's debts and then mediate to find solutions to the outstanding debt. But it's not enough just to have practice. We also need to look at regulation. And I agree wholeheartedly about looking at limits on the amount of interest that can be charged. I very much appreciate the push of the Children's Society about looking at advertising of loans to children. And in our pack, we got this leaflet about banning advertising of a Wonga, for example, to children. I think we should ban Wonga. I think you should forget about the advertising part. But I think that we have to look at how credit and debt is portrayed in our culture, that it's not easy. We also have to look at technology. One of the challenges we've seen, for example, in Sweden and Estonia now, is that you can get a loan by SMS, by a text message, sorry, SMS, I live in Belgium, you see, but by text message. So it's really popular amongst young people. You're out with your friend, you run out of money, aha, I can get 20 euros, 17 pounds, in my bank account in 20 minutes. By sending an SMS. That is so dangerous. We actually need to ban some types of lending, or at least have huge restrictions. And we also have to look at, as I said before, personal behaviour. We need more financial education at an earlier age. We need to use all the possibilities we have, community organisations. I used to be in the Guides, and I'm a big believer in scouting and guiding. We need to have financial education in youth organisations, in schools, in churches. We shouldn't be afraid of it. And we also have to work with the creditor, the persons and organisations lending. We have to look at how to have better mediation mechanisms and change some of the legislation that allows loans to be given too easily. I'm going to stop there, but I would just say don't forget that debt is not just an increasing UK phenomenon. It's something that's happening all over Europe. And with the advent of the crisis, what we are seeing more and more is what we call social contagion. We talk a lot about financial and economic contagion, but we're seeing social contagion. Increasing poverty and over-indebtedness in one country will have an effect on people in other countries as well. So it's important we keep that. And I know the next speaker is going to take that a bit further. Thank you.
Evening. My name is Tim Jones. I'm from Jubilee Debt Campaign. We're the campaign to cancel unjust international debts and take measures to prevent large debts increasing again. In April, I was in Jamaica and I met a nurse. Over the last 4 years, her pay has been cut by one third. And because of that, she has sometimes had to borrow in order to get the money for food and for the rent. And she told me, every time prices go up, we go and borrow to survive. Our pay goes straight to the lender. It's a lose-lose situation. We are in the same debt trap as the government. The debt trap that the Jamaican government is in is that for every £1 they earn, they spend 50 pence on debt repayments. And this is not a new story for Jamaica. It's not just happened since the most recent global financial crisis. It first began in the 1970s in the wake of a whole range of regulations that were removed, which allowed far more debts to be created between countries. And in the last 40 years, Jamaica has constantly been trying to make cuts in its budgets, restructure its economy, privatize industries in the name of paying this debt. But today, the debt is bigger than it has ever been. In the last 20 years in Jamaica, the number of women dying in childbirth has doubled. As health services have deteriorated, more women are now dying. And that is almost unheard of outside of war situations. But this is the desperation that the Jamaican economy has been put under. Now, I think here what is happening is not just an economic issue, it's a moral issue. So each time Jamaica is paying its debt, a judgment is being made that it's more important to pay that debt than it is to provide adequate healthcare. Each time the debt is paid, it's more important to pay the debt than to provide a wage that nurses can survive on. And each time debts are paid to payday lenders, it's making a moral judgment it's more important to pay those debts than to feed a family, than to provide income for to pay the rents. And so I think that this is the big challenge that we face, that morally in our society we have the view that paying a debt is a moral absolute. It's something that always needs to happen, and that comes before everything else. The Jubilee Debt Campaign comes out of the Jubilee that Michael was talking about. This was a time in the Jewish tradition when debts were cancelled between people and slaves were freed and land was redistributed. And Jubilee means a celebration. We celebrate because we are being released from these debts which have enslaved us. That concept was taken by people in the 1990s and was born the idea of let's have a jubilee for the millennium. Who went to Birmingham in 1998? Great. So there we called for the debts of the 52 most indebted countries to be cancelled for the millennium. Who went to Edinburgh in 2005? Fantastic. Now, as a result of our campaigning, $130 billion of debt has been cancelled. Now, across the world, 20 million people signed a petition calling for that. $130 billion is a large number. If you break it down, that means for every signature on that petition, $6,500 of debt was cancelled. And this is, I think, something we can celebrate. We didn't achieve everything that we wanted, but some change came. What we haven't managed to break down is our financial system that leads to a recurrence of debt crises. So because in the 1950s and 1960s, we had regulations on how much banks could lend and how easy it was for money to be lent between countries. Those were abolished in the 1970s, and ever since we've had a succession of crises across the world. In Africa, in Latin America, in East Asia, and now here in Europe, in countries like Greece, people are going through the same situation that others have faced across the world. So I want to suggest that this concept of Jubilee is one that we need to keep using, and not just think about in terms of international debts. This is something that there are always going to be occasions when sometimes debts should not be repaid. And morally, if we're going to take that forward, we need to make the argument that sometimes a morally best thing to do is actually for a debt not to be paid, and that the morally worst thing to do is for debts to continue to be repaid. And then hopefully we can build towards having far more celebrations of having times when people are released from the burden of unjust debts. Thank you.
I'm still not up. Am I up? Yes, I'm up. Thank you. Thanks very much. So just to quickly recap, so Katie was talking about the impact, particularly the impact of debt on children in the UK now and the very real impact that it's having. Michael was talking particularly, I think, about the role of government and raised the issue of usury as well. Heather talked about these four reasons, the income shock, personal financial management, financial exclusion, but the really interesting one for me was that also about this values, the values of consumerism and how we value people and how that leads them to think that there are things they need in order to be valued. But also making the point that this is not just a UK problem, it's actually a European problem, and then Tim taking it even wider. It's a global problem, but actually it's now coming home to roost, in a sense. So Tim was talking about the impact of the debt... impact of debt on the people within a country, the implicit moral judgment that's being made when we demand for repayment. And this thing about the $6,500 of debt cancelled for each signature really brings out the power of a lot of individual small acts to achieve something quite big. And the idea of reawakening the concept of Jubilee. Just to pick up on just a couple of things. So that concept of Jubilee as... it stems from biblical times, and in fact, I think it was in the Macedonian Empire, when basically the financial system was run by palaces and temples, there was a lot of the debt was paid in kind. So it would be, you know, shekels of wheat or something like that. If somebody's crop failed for 2 years in a row, that's it. The slate is washed clean. So, implicitly in the law, it took account of the ability to pay or not pay. I think that's where the term wiping the slate clean comes from. The law actually says the slate shall be washed in water. So, it's over to you guys. What are the questions that you've got for the panel that come out of what they've said? This one at the back there. While we're waiting for the microphone to make its way to the back, or to the middle, sorry, can I just ask, how many people, you don't have to answer this question if you feel it's embarrassing, but how many people in this audience have any debt of any kind? So it's not just a problem that's out there, it's, you know, we're all part of this system of debt. So,
Kit, it's a question for you. Really, as much as anybody.
No, that's not fair.
Because you're
sharing,
honestly. You're a banker. I used to work for Santander,
yeah.
Abbey, as it was, managing property, nothing to do with the money. But I heard the term subprime a good number of years ago. And the idea that subprime meant that you could charge more interest, a bit like payday loaners and such like. Do you want to comment on Islamic banking principles?
Yes, okay. So Islamic banking principles are based on the idea that you don't charge interest. I have a slight from my personal understanding, okay, usury is actually a term that has changed in meaning. So in biblical times, it meant that it was against the law to lend for gain, actually. It didn't use the word interest. It was lending for gain. And somewhere around the 13th to the 16th centuries, I'm not sure when, it changed to being lending for extortionate rates of interest. Now, I think that the issue now is that there are definitely some people who are being lent to where the feeling is, because the risk is higher, it's okay for me to charge a very high rate of interest. The question is, I think, at what point is it appropriate to say, do you know what, that risk is so high that you really shouldn't be borrowing in the first place. So, but your question about Sharia, Islamic banking, my puzzle, I suppose, about it is I don't understand, and I haven't really quizzed anybody about it, but I don't really understand what the difference is between a bank lending at an interest rate of, say, 6%, and an Islamic bank saying, well, you need a return of 6%, so we're going to find something, some way of giving you a return of 6%, but not calling it interest. So I don't understand quite how that meets the original biblical or Old Testament, i.e. the same piece of law that they're working to, that we kind of work to. I don't understand how it meets that requirement. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. So I think that maybe a good way of understanding what is a fair rate of interest would be to say, is the benefit of this debt being shared equally between the person who's lending and the person who's borrowing? So if the person who's borrowing is getting some benefit and they're sharing that benefit fairly with the person who's lending them the money, that's okay. If one is exploiting the other, that's wrong. This one at the back. Do any of you, sorry, before we do that, do any of you have any comments on that as well?
I think this, there we go. I think this is somewhere where morality and economics collides in quite a troubling way. So in the financial markets, it's known that if you are charging a higher rate of interest, there's an assumption there's a chance that debt might not be able to be repaid. And there's companies going bankrupt, debts being cancelled all the time in within the financial world. But then when it comes closer to our lives, it becomes not so easy for the debts to be cancelled because we think debts must always be paid. So when it's a government debt or a personal level debt, it's like seen as an act of failure if that debt isn't repaid and something that you have morally badly, you've done bad. So I think that's something why it's so important. We need to challenge this idea that a debt not being paid is a bad thing. That if we lending is great, it allows us to share resources and allows this risk to be shared, but that means that the lender needs to bear responsibility. So if the loan doesn't work out, then the debts do need to be written off. But the closer it gets to our lives, the harder that seems to be, because we have this moral concept that not paying a debt is a bad thing.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, it's also a question about people who are experiencing over-indebtedness are not likely to be borrowing from the bank, whether it be a high street bank or an Islamic bank or whatever bank it might be. They're likely to be buying from, let's say, private lending sources that are both, some of which are not legal. I mean, let's be honest about this too. And there is a poverty premium. There is a poverty, it costs more to borrow money if you are experiencing poverty than if you're not. And your interest rate will be higher the lower your income. And we have a fundamental problem with our society and our economic system that says the poorer you are, the harder it is for you to get out of your problems. And that's why I think that it's a great step forward that the Church of England and the Church of Scotland have just signed the agreement to form a credit union for, at the moment, for church staff, but there is hope that it'll go further, that churches across the UK are getting more and more involved in local credit unions, because we need to find new ways that people who experience income shocks in particular, and it can be as basic a thing as your washing machine breaking down. Where do you find the money to get that? Now, going to the bank with the best will in the world are not going to lend you the money for a washing machine. But where do you get it? How do you keep your kids' clothes clean, as in the Children's Society report? So we need more alternative forms that move us away from the interest-bearing loans and lending that we currently have that are crippling many, many families. And we also need some regulation as to what level of interest is acceptable. And one of the things that's pushed, I think, from the Children's Society and from ourselves is also the concept of breathing space when it comes to paying back loans and dealing with interest. Because what can often be the issue is that a family can pay back the principal loan, but they cannot deal with the interest. And a grace period, a breathing space, a period of jubilee, if you like, to be able to repay the original debt but have the interest relieved in some way would also make a difference.
Do either of the other two have any thoughts to add?
Okay.
So there was another question at the back, I think.
As someone who's just entering into the economic and financial experiences of being an adult, when I was a child, I wouldn't have really cared about understanding finances. So how would you make... But you need to understand before you get into these situations as an adult. And how do you make a child care about what's going to happen so many years down the line when they need to know then?
Okay, thanks. Katie, do you want to take that one? Maybe there's some
So what we're seeing is that actually children do care. The fact that when we did our research, we had one in three children saying that they understood a little bit more about sort of finances and things like APR because they've seen payday loan ads on the TV, but they wasn't getting that in school, I think shows that they do want that. There is an appetite for it. And it is now law that each child in school is going to get financial education, but what we need to push for is to ensure that that financial education is of a standard that it makes it easy for them to be in this consumer society understanding what borrowing or not borrowing money is about. With our work with the Church of England around a saving scheme, ensuring that children in school are more aware of the alternatives. So we don't want children to believe the alternative to a high street bank is Wonga. We want them to believe the alternative to a high street bank is their local credit union. And one way that we can do that is ensuring that each child leaves school with a credit union account means it might foster that feeling that they're part of something they should do when they're an adult. But, something that we really care about is these children that are living under the shadow of debt as children don't repeat some of that when they become an adult.
Michael, do you see people coming to university fully engaged with the financial system, or are they kind of...
Well, it was very clear that, and Peter Selvin made the point very well in his book, Grace and Mortgage, that the generation of children that have grown up since tuition fees have been charged were basically being introduced to debt at a very early age in order to get their education. And he argued that, in fact, this was a larger issue, and the idea was to educate young people to living with debt permanently throughout their lives. Now, you might say that's very far-fetched, but the fact of the matter is now, with the tripling of fees, that young people are looking at £40,000, £50,000 worth of debt in order to get a degree in this country, which is unique in Europe. And the only other place where this happens is the United States. And, of course, in the US, the loans that students take out are some of the worst-paying loans in terms of payback. So all the sums our civil servants did were wrong because they didn't look at the actual market in higher education debt. But it's clear that the strategy works in this sense, that the US is the most highly accustomed society in the world to debt-based consumption. And this has been the case really since 1980, since Reaganomics, because what Reaganomics did was to destroy the jobs and the trade unions of the working classes, to destroy the industrial manufacturing base, so that even Levi's are now made in China, and depriving millions and millions of people of jobs, black and white people in North American cities. Then the credit was at the same time deregulated. And the idea was then that the people who no longer had any income would be able to borrow money and carry on consuming the things they were no longer involved in making and deriving any benefit from financially in the process. And again, I'm not making this up. And of course, ultimately, this is what led to the financial crash in 2008. Because first we had an explosion in consumer debt for white goods, every other kind of good, and then we had an explosion in housing finance debt, where you had people going around selling houses to other people who clearly couldn't afford them. This was the cause of the financial crash. Basically, an economy based upon people who own property and people who have properly paid jobs, not pauper jobs, which is what the minimum wage is, and don't therefore need assistance from the government. That is the basis for an efficient economy. What Thatcher and Reagan and what that economics we've been taught for the last 30 years is, at the basis of an efficient economy is a small number of extremely rich people who are in the position to buy up property on a large scale, including public services. And all the evidence, and Piketty, the French economist, is just the latest to assemble the evidence, is that those kinds of economies are the most inefficient in the world. And this is why we are taking so long to come out of austerity, and the US as well, because we have an... If you give money to the poorest people, they spend it straight away. If you give money to the richest people, they don't spend it. A lot of it ends up in tax havens. It's insane. But that's the policy we're currently pursuing in this country. It's economically unproductive, even if we ignore the ethics of it.
Thank you. Can we take another question? Who's got the mic? Thank you.
It's quite easy to get support for the idea of banning Monga, and it was quite clear.
Sorry, can you speak up a bit?
Am I not being clear?
The competition. Yeah, thank you.
It's quite easy to get support, particularly in an audience like this, for banning Monga, but the difficulty is that people go to Monga because they have no other support structure. And therefore, if you try hard to ban all these systems without the support structure being in place, then you're going to push people even further over the edge.
Who'd like to take that? Heather?
Yeah. Of course, I completely agree to you. When I said let's ban Wonga, it should be not because there shouldn't be anything left for people to get assistance from, but we shouldn't be having payday loans as the solution to poverty or risk of poverty. That's my point. The solutions to poverty or risk of poverty is looking at adequate income support, good wages. It's about looking at having a good accompanying services to assist people to work and to integrate in their community. So just as debt itself is multifaceted, so are the solutions to debt and so are the solutions to poverty. But we also shouldn't be promoting a culture of some of these payday loans and other types of loans as well. The problem with something like Wonga is it's become culturally relevant. Mm. You know, this is exactly why there's a push to ban advertising. I mean, you watch a Wonga advert. When is it on TV? It's not on TV late at night. It's on when Jeremy Kyle is on. It's on in the morning when people are stuck at home. It's exactly there to tempt people. It's a temptation, and they're cuddly old age people, whoever in them. So we need to find the alternatives. We need to find good income support, reliable and accessible social welfare for people. But we also have to take out the things that are, frankly, no, I won't use the word I was going to use, but I'll just say that shouldn't be the cultural norm of dealing with debt.
So for us, obviously, we don't want these families going to Wonga, but we don't want these families going to the alternatives. In some of the communities where we work, the alternatives are not Wonga, we collecting debts with overzealous bailiffs. These are people collecting debts with baseball bats, and that's not the alternative. So we need to have that something in place that sort of does what payday loans. Somebody... People are always going to have a shock in their income. They may lose their job. They may have a breakdown that's essential to their life. They're going to need to lend some money from somewhere if they're not earning or being able to the answer is resilience, but these people don't earn enough to have savings. They don't earn enough to take money out of pensions. So they're going to need to go somewhere. And they need something that's like Wonga. That what Wonga does that makes it so attractive to people is that you're guaranteed the money. There is nowhere else where you can go to where you're guaranteed to get that money to fix the thing in your life, and that's the biggest problem. So we need to ensure that those alternatives, which to us is the credit unions and other community-based solutions for the money and for the lending, we need to ensure that they are sustainable, that they are there and they are open to everybody, not just the people that may be involved in their local churches or their local youth groups or with the children's society. So I think that's what's really important, is not just banning Wonga for Wonga's sake, but ensuring that they have to ban themselves, because there is not a place for them anymore in a sustainable financial future in this country.
Thank you. Thanks, Katie. Michael, can I just pick up, because you were also talking about putting a regulatory cap on interest rates, and I guess that effectively that would have some of the same effect, because if nobody's allowed to lend at 4,000%, then that's Wonga's business model coming crashing to the floor, and therefore those people who are currently going to Wonga will still have to go somewhere to get that money. So can we do that at the same time as, or have we got enough of a safety net? What is the safety net if we were to impose that, or if we were to ban Wonga? Either way, I think we'd have the same effect.
The reply you get from George Osborne, the Treasury, is that, you know, it just can't be done. But this is not true. Debt is regulated in other countries. The reason the debt is not regulated in the United Kingdom is because of the sovereign power of the City of London. Not many people know that the City of London is a square mile owned by a private corporation which was set up by the Dutch and is not subject to British sovereign rule. When the sovereign enters the City of London, she has to leave her sceptre and another instrument officially aside. It's part of the ritual that she goes through on that annual event when she goes into the city. This was because the city lent to a predecessor of hers, and that was the deal. So we have a sovereign territory inside a sovereign territory, which is not subject to Parliament. And that sovereign territory tells Parliament what it may or may not do. And that sovereign territory refuses to regulate debt, because its business is debt. And its business has been debt since it was founded. In my view, not the City of London's view, but in my view, there would be absolutely no problem in imposing a cap of, say, something ludicrously high, like 100%. Which none of us in this room, I doubt, has ever paid. Anybody here ever paid a loan at a rate of 100%? Anybody ever paid a loan at a rate of 50% in this room? What about 30%? Yeah, I have in the past bought a washing machine when I had to cure it at a rate of 30%, right? So I would say 30%. That to me was usurious. That's enough usury for a country to regulate. I'd have no problem with 30%. And of course, if the top rate was 30%, then that would become the rate that the poorest paid, and you would then get a new ecosystem of debt, which would be a lot healthier than the one we have at the moment. And I have no doubt that commercial companies would find ways of using this new ceiling to lend money to the poor, as well as credit unions, which, of course, all of us here would rather see.
Thank you. Another question? Who's got the mic? Down here now. Great.
I'm struck by the need or the responsibility of employers to pay fair wages. And my recent experience is I work in a school, and 10% of the employees, 250 employees, 10% of them were on the minimum wage. But by putting them onto the living wage, the impact on those employees has been significant, in as much as they've enjoyed a pay rise of about 13%. So I'd encourage people who work in schools or other organisations to think about whether they can do that too, because it makes a big difference.
As a way of sort of lifting people a little bit out of poverty. Thanks very much. Yeah.
If I can just make a wee comment on that. In the European Union, the most recent statistics are that there are 117 million people experiencing poverty or at risk of poverty based on a number of different criteria, one of which is in-work poverty. There's been a piece of research just done by the European Commission. It was launched earlier this year, The biggest increase in poverty will be seen from in-work poverty in the next 2 years. Also, extreme destitution and homelessness for some member states. But the biggest push now is on getting employers to pay a fair wage, because it's the biggest growing group of people experiencing poverty in the whole of Europe, in 28 member states.
Michael.
There's a reason for this. About 30 years ago, well, 40, I studied economics in the early 1970s, and it was around that time, around 1970, corporations, people who run capitalism, decided that they weren't getting a fair deal anymore. They weren't getting a big enough slice of the cake. And the reason was the trade unions. They brought into power Reagan and Thatcher and others like them in Europe, whose principal work for the corporations was to destroy the working classes, to destroy the industrial economy, and to destroy trade unions. They succeeded. We are one of the least unionized countries now in Europe, and we are the least unionized that we have been in over 100 years. Unions are a source of democracy and equality, and they are a source of social insurance and protection when you're out of work, and when you're in work, protection from your employer. That has been destroyed, and it is absolutely tragic. It's a small percentage now. It's something like 25% of people in this country. I'm not sure of the precise statistic, but it's below the majority now in the union. And the people least likely now to be unionized are the poorest people. So the people in catering, in construction, in hospitality, in retail. These people are now very rarely in unions, and these are all poorly paid people. And this has become mainstream Tory policy. In the 18th century, there was a famous Tory called William Cobbett, who I deeply admire. I admire Edmund Burke as well. Tories didn't used to be like the Tories we have today. These people aren't really Tories, in my view. And William Cobbett wrote a wonderful book called Rural Rights. He wrote many other books. He was arrested at least once and put in jail for a year or so for being a bit of a subversive. But the point is, he also owned land. He refused to employ paupers on his land. Now, a pauper was someone, even in the 18th century, who was paid so badly they had to receive assistance from the parish. They were on the parish, as they used to say in those days. And he refused to do this, and he argued in Parliament that it was unjust and wrong for anyone to propose to carry on paying people below a living wage. So this is a very old argument. It was the unions, not the Tories, who ultimately listened to William Cobbett and took up the cause. The decline of union power has led to a decline in wages for the majority of people below. If you look at the median versus the average wage is very misleading. The median wage in this country is around 20,000, which is really shocking. But there are many, many people who are not even earning that. So that's the basic problem we have in this country now. And it isn't, again, simply about the suffering of people, as if that wasn't enough of a reason to fix it. It's also about the reason why this country is now so unproductive compared to many of our competitors. Because the less property, the more maldistributed property and income are, the less productive is your economy.
Thank you. It's just a little interesting aside on the living wage. So we're a living wage employer. But in order to do that, because we subcontract our cleaning contract, it means that we have to insist that the cleaning company pays the cleaners who clean our office a living wage, which means that they're paid more than all their colleagues. So, and what we hope is that that will then sort of push the influence a bit further. But it is an interesting one. You have to kind of go a little bit beyond the boundaries. Next question. Who's got the mic?
Yes. Over here. Can I just pick up on Heather's point, an advocate of being advocate.
Speak up, please.
I am. I have it really close.
Can you ramp up the volume a bit? Thanks.
I just wanted to pick up and encourage Heather in your points about the impact that we can have in terms of countering income shock and personal financial management, and that actually at local community levels, we as the church can do that one by one with families, with individuals, and it is relatively simple for us to equip ourselves in being able to provide debt and benefit advice at a very cheap level and yet committed level. And I personally have had the joy of actually walking alongside individuals in our community and seeing them experience that taste of the kingdom of God, where they are released from the oppression of poverty and find freedom in their own financial management and experience more of the kingdom of God in that. And I just want to say that it's been a joy to do and be part of, and something that has been relatively simple to set up in a proper and accountable way, and yet has had a dramatic impact upon the 150, 200 families that we now have served in the last two, three years in one of the, well, in the poorest parish of the Diocese of Winchester, and it's been terrific. And I just would encourage us as a Christian community to be able to do that.
Thank you. That's brilliant. Thank you.
We've got time for one more question. I know the gentleman over here has had his hand up for a while. Thank you.
A debt that hangs over too many people's lives today, and I'd like to hear mentioned from you, is that of rent arrears and too many tenants being at the mercy of greedy landlords. Are there any conversations taking place on how to campaign for the reintroduction of the Fair Rents Act?
Katie, do you want us to start with that, and then perhaps Tim, you could pick that up on a sort of more international context as well?
I think he was trying to trick me up by making me go first. Certainly not from the Children's Society is that anything we're going to be campaigning on in the immediate future. But we appreciate the issues with housing. Myself personally know from being a renter in London how difficult it is, and I earn far higher than the median wage. But what I think, along with things like caps and on rent caps and things, is about building. The houses are not being built. We have got builders out there who have got no jobs. The construction could put money into the economy that will take down that national debt. We could bring down VAT. We could stop people having to have money to prop up scandalous landlords. But one of the things is for us is about building more houses that families can live in comfortably. Because I think we all see these properties up and down the country where families are expected to live in less than places that we wouldn't expect anybody to live. So I think that's one of the things we should do.
Thank you. Tim, do you want
to... Yeah, I think housing is a really key issue. I've been loosely involved in some groups in London. There's a coalition called London Renters who have been campaigning, holding occupations in support of getting things like rent controls back in to get rents under control. So that is very vital. Another vital thing, I want to stand up for how debt can be good. At the moment, it's the cheapest time in history for the UK government to borrow money. So now is the ideal time for the UK to do things like build public housing. And that would actually save the government money because it would reduce the horrendous amount that is given to landlords through the housing benefit, which is really just a subsidy to landlords to make even more profit out of their homes. So, and then I think there's a third way that housing comes in is that, I mean, I live in London, so this may be particularly an issue there, of housing being bought up by money coming from overseas, and London's become this place where you put your money in order to keep it safe somewhere, and that is what helps push up house prices and rents. And what we need to do is have controls so you can say, actually, if you're from overseas, you cannot buy up the housing. And these are the kind of controls that used to exist in the 50s and 60s, when we had a much more stable international financial system. They have been made illegal under various international trade agreements, the European Union, the World Trade Organization. But this is a big picture challenge in the financial system that we need to do as well as all of the fantastic stuff on the ground if we're really to build a more sustainable financial system. I just want to mention that we've brought out a booklet of six Bible studies on economics. So it covers things like inequality, tax dodging, all these issues of debt that we've been talking about tonight, both personal debts and international debts. So I think there's a few available at the back, but also on our stall in a G-source.
Great. Heather, did you want to just make one quick point before we finish?
Just say on housing, in fact, there's a lot of research that shows that housing is the last thing that people will compromise on. That families experiencing over-indebtedness tend to be in arrears with utility bills first, and their housing is absolutely last. And one of the feedback that comes, and it's very important, we've discussed this here tonight, but actually we should be also discussing this with people who are experiencing such crippling debt as well. And many people will say that the issue is not being able to move to cheaper housing quicker enough. And that's partly because of the housing stock that has been said. It's also about the administrative burden of trying to move even within the social housing sector. So we need to build more homes, we need to have more social housing, but we also need to make it easier for people to make that move when their housing costs become prohibitive.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for all your questions. And thank you to Katie, Michael, Heather and Tim. I've certainly learned a lot. I didn't know that the City of London was separately, a separate regime. I thought they were regulated like the rest of us, but there you go. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks very much to the panel. Fascinating discussion. Another warm round of applause. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you.